tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 108 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. We've got a three-person scrappy crew here today. I'm Rick.
And I'm Mark.
And this is Lauren.
And Lauren went last because she's got the highest latency connection. She's you're still in Barcelona, is that right, Lauren?
That's right. It's my second week here after VMworld and now OpenStack Summit.
Damn.
I bet you were ready to come home on Thursday, though.
I am very ready.
Hey, so did you find batteries in Barcelona on Sunday?
No, I had to wait till Monday. The weirdest thing.
Wow, so did you go to the Parkwell gift shop and you know?
No, I decided to just wait it out. I stole some batteries from the hotel remote, and that sufficed for a few hours.
Oh, I do. That's the best trick. Put in dead batteries, or at least take one dead battery from the hotel remote. And
I hate you guys. You know what? I hate you guys. You know, because if there's one thing I love, it's getting the hotel, trying to use the remote, and it's like dead batteries in there. Now I know.
Yeah, you can blame me. I usually only take one.
The next time that happens, I'm going to take the batteries out of that remote. I'm going to write your name on them, Rick. I'm going to insert them in a voodoo doll, and I'm going to put that voodoo doll in a blender. That's what I'm going to do.
Ouch. That I will feel from here. Well, friends, we have, six items tonight, including one hot or not. I'll go through the quick list, and then we'll jump into it. And this one is very relevant to the interwebs, an article from The Atlantic talking about how a bunch of hacked DVRs took down Twitter and Reddit. Say it isn't so. That's a fact.
Lauren probably didn't even know what that was going on because she's like in Europe doing Europe stuff.
I did notice like a little bit on the tail end of Twitter.
What happened over there, you guys? Heavily drinking.
It was a really good party. And then also making our headline this week is a new Amazon Web Services budget calculator. Go figure. And then acquisition news, some big billions flowing around possibly with AT&T to purchase Time Warner. News.
And both Trump and Hillary oppose it.
Why would that be? Well, and then interesting situation from Cohesity, their chief operating officer has been cut loose due to an HR probe. And of course, with a title like that, you think they'd have details. Alas, not so.
And you always have to love that word probe.
Yeah, probe.
Especially coming from HR.
Ooh. Hey now. This is a family show, Mark. And then lastly, the Google Cloud Platform.
It's a family probe.
Does that mean it has like six handles or something? And then Google's Cloud Platform gets a new cold storage service just in time for winter. So let's start with the hacked DVRs. Granted, you weren't affected, Lauren, but you had an opinion. What'd you think?
Well, it's interesting, you know. I mean, what went down? Twitter, Reddit, a few other sites, and it says not one, I don't know, company or whatever was specifically hit. Hackers were going after DNS and Dyn with a DDoS attack. The article I was reading was saying that this is the largest successful attack that has happened, which I find hard to believe. I mean, we were just talking a few weeks ago about how people or hackers have been testing the DDoS attacks against DNS for weeks or months, maybe even years, is my guess. And maybe this was the largest attack, but I find that hard to believe. You know, we also had the attacks last Christmas on Microsoft and whatnot. So I don't know. What did you guys think about it?
Well, I think that the first Internet of Things attack should be an eye opener. Everything from, you know, granted, this particular example were DVR machines, but, you know, I've seen a couple of my bloggerati friends share their diagrams of their smart homes, but add up how many things now, guys, are connected to the internet that are not a computer, phone, or tablet. It might be kind of scary. I've got two thermostats. I've got two plus an undescribed other quantity of personal webcams around the house, right? And, you know, those types of things, and maybe a Nest, maybe a Roku, you know, that's a kind of a DVR, maybe a, you know, Apple TV, those other things, you know, all these different devices, the connected home. I've seen refrigerators, I've seen garage door openers, keyless entry systems, you know, maybe additional DIY security systems. You know, they all are having this type of risk. And the thought of a Internet of Things, you know, vulnerability, forget how it propagated and kind of went into something that presumably doesn't change its browsing habits. But this could be a real big deal. You know, there, you could have people's residential network, home networks and internet traffic just be totally crap forever due to this webcam that's messed up. Or it could be something where you have them connecting to something on the internet and taking down a real mainstream service. So kind of an eye opener that it's A, taking this long, but B, how impactful it can be.
Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, I was with Stephen Foskett's Storage Field Day number 11. And one of the things that came up when we were, you know, the group was hanging out or riding around somewhere was this concept of, you know, abandonware becoming, you know, the plague of the internet. And, you know, it's got me thinking, right? So I don't necessarily know how to protect or change my DVR, right? I've got a Comcast DVR. I think I set up a password for it. I don't have remote access working for it. For instance, I don't log into my DVR from my phone remotely and record a show or anything like that. I haven't set it up. But maybe the thing still has a default password that I never set up, you know, and I don't even know, you know, and so it's possible my DVR might have been a part of that. And people have routers in their houses, you know, and a lot of the, you know, the internet routers that they have, you know, probably haven't been updated ever, right? When's the last time you guys, well, you guys are techies, but when's the last time you updated your router in your houses with firmware?
See, my main router, the Untangle, automatically updates itself. The one that the cable company provided me, I don't touch. But
yeah, hey, Lauren, so what about you?
Yeah, I run Meraki, so it gets updated pretty frequently just on its own. But yeah, like Rick said, you know, the cable modem or whatever is provided by the cable company, who the hell knows?
Yeah, so apparently, you know, all this, the idea of abandonware is you've got this stuff that's, you know, the firmware is years old, and a lot of the time it's got the default passwords in it. So, you know, people can hack into that stuff, and there you go. You know, the attack of the zombie abandonware, you know, electronic appliances.
I think it's going to be more risk to come. I don't think this is going to be the first such occurrence of this. Interesting.
So, you know, one of the other things that was really interesting about this was the sort of the politicizing of it. I think the New York Times was really quick to say, it's Russia. Russia's attacking us, right? And who is the guy, Shiner, who, you know, Lauren, who is the expert?
Schneier. Bruce Schneier.
Yeah, Bruce Schneier. So he had written about this, and he figured it was, you know, people trying to target and deal with. I'm trying to remember the other guy who exposes hackers on the web. He's at New.
Is that Krebs?
Yeah, Krebs. And he figures it was guys because Krebs was also getting attacked at the same time. And so he figured that this was actually not a nation state doing it, but it was hackers who had put together an organized attack to, you know, basically rain down shit on Krebs.
Ooh, interesting.
I know, yeah. There's a lot of intrigue to this, right? Mm. This Krebs guy might actually really be something if people are going to this level of disruption to mess with them.
I think you're right, Mark. It's probably less of the major attack and more indicative of something coming in the future. And, you know, we're not securing most of these devices. So, and people, even if people knew how, I don't think we would be able to, because there are things like DVRs that you're not going to get into, you know, the settings panel. So I don't know. Vendors need to come together, I think, to make sure appliances in general that connect to anything are more secure.
I think I'm going to need to modernize my home network with different trust zones for, you know, smart home automation devices and, you know, networks that have devices with data. It's going to look like a freaking service provider by the time I'm done with it. I have to set up a new household budget for technology to get it right, which is a great segue to the new Amazon Web Services budgeting tool, which, you know, that's something that the budget, the cost, the money. I've had situations where you go and ask for money and you say, how much is it going to cost? They say, you don't know. It's based on what we use. And I've actually had the workplace say no for things like that. So a new budgeting tool is going to help finance managers and such get their head around, you know, information on this.
So, no, we need a little more background here. Yeah, yeah. What the hell is this thing?
Well, it is well, the Register puts it in the best angle. They say, why not run two versions of services and turn on the bad one once budgets run low, which is kind
so
of
this,
funny.
So that didn't answer the question. This is a tool that Amazon gives people to model or figure out how much they're going to spend on their shit?
That's basically what it looks like.
Yeah, basically it's kind of like before we weren't necessarily getting accurate pictures of how much things would cost. This update to the calculator will allow us to see exactly how much we are spending and even allow us to maybe automate switching to, like you said, Rick, if we're running our application in two different spots, maybe we switch to the cheaper spot, or stop using such intense services and whatever.
Well, it's calculating costs of services. And when it comes to, especially if you go all in on something like Amazon, where you've got different business units. See, here's the potential problem. If you are an organization, I think this is the one part that's missing in this. If you're an organization, no matter what you do, it all comes down to something called an allocation cost. Who's taking how much of what? So you might have this $5,000 a month Amazon bill, but what if 75% of it is this group and 13% is that group and whatever? This type of tool is really going to help you separate what's used, different, you know, compute, storage, whatever, app services to the different groups and how they're using it. So I think that this is one of those things that's going to start and take on a lot of iterative improvements based on feedback, but kind of a big deal because one of the things that the Reg even linked in here is how Dropbox evacuated Amazon reportedly as one of the reasons due to cost, but to have these tools to help, you know, look at these costs of apps, services, databases, whatever are being used in Amazon. I think that's a business thing that people need.
Yeah. So if they're going to do a departmental accounting, that would make sense, right? But if they're going to try to model how much all of this stuff is going to cost in the future, I don't know why Amazon would do this because everybody would just say, hell with this. I'm going to do it myself. This cloud stuff is like way too expensive.
It does.
You know, it's out of control. It's going crazy. I mean, Amazon, it doesn't have a tool out there that allows people to say, oh my God, we're going to pay all our income to Amazon.
Right. And Amazon is like a drug where there's nothing but, you know, resources available for consumption and there's no built-in housekeeper. So there's going to be phantom cloud resources. I still get a bill for $3 a month on Amazon and I haven't used it in years. I'm just too lazy to go clean it up, right? So
abandoned cloud with real invoice, real money leaving your bank account.
Exactly. Yeah. So
to fund Jeff Bezos. Oh, Lauren, you can say something.
The point that the Register brings up as well is, are IT companies going to build applications two times or more times? And if you're going to already build it over here, then why bother with AWS and all of that? And I don't think that's the point either, though. I think you absolutely are going to have applications and services be redundant in different, not only different clouds, but on-premises and off-premises, and then deciding which is cheaper at the time, because I think that's always going to change as well. I think that it's naive to think that we're going to have a fixed cost for even an entire year, much less several years, much less maybe a couple months at a time. So I think absolutely companies probably are going to have that redundancy built into their applications. And they may switch back and forth between, you know, what's inexpensive at the time or what's running well at the time, the performance versus cost ratio. So that's, you know, I think this is the new world order here. And I think it's good that Amazon, among other, I think Google and Azure also updated their calculators too. And I think it's great that they are doing this and allowing us to use the APIs to automate, you know, which cloud we're going to use at the time, possibly.
Well, then it becomes a very interesting interconnected experience. And in the Reg article, they cite one example where they want to operate a web service on a fixed budget. And then they can use AWS Lambda to, you know, control the app if costs are approaching the budget, which is very interesting to me. Meaning it says, quote, the app could take corrective action to ensure that the budget is not exceeded, disabling some services or computationally intense features or whatever. Very interesting idea there of setting a cloud service with a fixed budget, and the fact that you could have mechanisms in place to help enforce that. You know, if you think about that use case, I think that's really walking down the angle of having the best of both worlds, except does that mean that do you lose BI or do you lose customer experience or what has to go here with some of those adjustments? But I think I like the way they're thinking, honestly.
Does anybody know what happens if you have a dispute with Amazon where Amazon says you use six of these and you say, no, I use two? You know, does anybody know what happens there?
You get the cloud finger, pointing fingers. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I assume there's some way to prove it on either side, but, you know, it probably depends on how good of an Amazon customer you are and what your future is.
I want my data center in the Missouri area just because it's the show me state.
Yeah, so, you know, that's going to be interesting, right? There probably are cases where people go to Amazon, they say, no effing way, there's no way we did it. And then you find out that there's somebody, you know, somebody inside the development organization that's set up and torn down all this stuff, and they just thought they were getting it for free. It's kind of like the beer and wine in the hotel rooms when they first had hotel bars, right? I don't know if any of you guys were traveling back then, but I remember I had a roommate once, you know, and he thought that all of the stuff in the hotel bar was just gratis.
Oh, geez.
Wow.
It was hilarious. You know, the same thing could be sort of going on if people don't see the bills. Maybe that's why Amazon needs to, like, make sure that somebody can get the bill and fan it out to the organization so everybody knows that, in fact, they are using resources so you don't have these problems. It's like, actually, we gave you a detailed accounting of all of this, and somebody's using it there. And it's like, okay.
Well, and the other thing is you could be aiming for like a nano instance on EC2, like a T2 with 512 megabytes of memory, one processor, but you accidentally, instead of selecting the absolute smallest, you chose the absolute largest of a D2 with 244 gigs of memory and 36 CPUs. There's a significant difference in the price per hour, right?
Yeah, and off by one. Up by one letter.
Yeah, instead of, you know, I wanted D, not T. You know, the D and T sound alike, right? Delta, Tango, right? I wanted a Tango 2, not a Delta 2. And, you know, if you think about that type of thing, the first or the last, depending on which one you look at, smallest is biggest, is a significant difference. So that type of stuff probably happens all the time.
Yeah, not only that, there will be this cacophony of data out there. It's like, well, I use this app over here and added some of this data, and I use something similar to that, or, you know, I kind of use the same data, made a copy of it over here. It'll be like having 15 USB sticks, you know, on your desktop, and you're thinking, which one has the last version of the presentation on it? Except it'll actually be machine data. You know, will we actually be able to tell where the most current versions of all the stuff is, or the most relevant data is that we need for whatever it is that we're working on, if we've been keeping it in five or six places and working on it there? It's going to be a mess.
Cloudfinger, watch out. It hurts.
Cloudfinger. I know the Cloudfinger is going to be after me. I don't know what got into me today. I'm just like, I'm freaking anti-cloud today, or anti-Amazon or something.
Before we started, you were quite anti-Windows 10 as well.
Yeah, that's the kind of day I'm having. I was totally anti-Windows 10.
How do you feel about AT&T and Time Warner, Mark?
What do I think of it? Man, why don't they just throw Comcast in there too and just have one big giant media company?
Well, you're seeing some things happen in this space, and AT&T is one that I've been watching, and Time Warner is not something that I've been watching, but I do know in my market, those are really the two, you know, cable options. So really you're without a hard line option for the most of my city market that I live in here. I've been watching AT&T because I think they're building something truly spectacular, and it's going to include television experience. It's going to include residential broadband, It's going to include their satellite offerings. It's going to include their mobile phone offerings, right? I think that there will be a day in the not too distant future where you go to one of these providers, and right now AT&T's got the footprints and everything from satellite, Wi-Fi, residential service, television service, you know, residential internet and television service. There's going to be a time where you go all in with AT&T and you have this completely mobile experience. In the car, you've got your DirecTV and your Wi-Fi. At home, you've got all of that. You've got your cell phone. And I just think there's going to be this seamless experience. I mean, T-Mobile's scheming up some interesting things too. I use that for my mobile, my phone right now, and I'm loving it. But I'm watching AT&T because I think they're scheming something truly spectacular.
Yeah, they'll probably have everything except the Sharks games on it, and then it'll drive me nuts. I'll have to quit and go back to Comcast to watch the Sharks.
Well, that's where Disney comes in then. You get your other huge media company.
Oh, yeah, Disney's a media company too. And then Trump is going to have a media company, we hear. For everybody,
it's going to be the best media company in the world.
For everybody that's angry, it's going to be called the Angry Old White Men Media Network.
I'm not saying a word.
You know, it is. I've heard basically everyone, at least you know, government, whatever, be against this acquisition, merger, what have you. Mark Cuban had an interesting take in that it will be the only way for some of these, I guess, legacy media companies to keep up with the likes of Google and, all of the other kind of apps that have come out, in order to consume media, essentially. So I don't know. It's an interesting take on it. And, certainly I do think that there's a new wave of cord cutters and various ways to consume our information. Now our TV and our movies. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I feel like this is some sort of monopoly or if it really is just a way for them to compete. Although, you know, as a cord cutter myself, I just think back to my bills that I used to get, and I kind of don't care if they are losing money, quite frankly.
Yeah, so they don't have Netflix, right? Netflix is still independent, and but you'll have if you subscribe to the AT&T Megadeth Star or whatever, you'll get supposedly Netflix over that, and that's interesting. But you won't. Geez. Yeah, there's got to be cheaper ways to do this. I mean, think of all of the debt that they're going to carry on this thing and what it's going to cost their consumers, right? No, but I mean, the argument against doing this is just that $70 billion more debt or whatever it is, you know, really? Really? Who's going to pay for that shit?
Netflix doesn't want to get into owning satellites or lines. No. AT&T has a lot of that stuff. And their big competition, I think, over the long-term emerging side is Google, and to an extent, like the Verizons and whom else's. But
more than Comcast?
In Comcast, I'm just drawing a blank because they're not in my market. But, you know, I think that Netflix is not a big deal. I think that's just kind of co-opetition. You know?
No, Netflix is a huge deal because how much of the internet bandwidth do they consume, right?
Significant amount.
What little company, I mean, they're an enormous deal.
Okay, true, but nobody's going to...
They don't have the infrastructure.
They're not going to drop AT&T to go with Netflix because they need some connectivity. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to argue with. It's a necessary evil. In order to eat my cereal, I need a bowl, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, but this is like network merged with content, right? You know, AT&T, the networking company, merged with Time Warner, the content company, right? And they're trying to fuse these things together, and it's like, really, $70 billion of worth of content, you know, for what? Really?
Well,
wow.
Well, but Time Warner does have a lot of, aside from the content business, they have a lot of metro services. Like here in Ohio, Time Warner's the 300-pound gorilla for home internet and cable TV, and it sucks.
Oh, they've got cable there. Uh-huh. Okay.
In my market.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a little bit of that, but I'm already using AT&T. And I was the first guy in the neighborhood to get the fiber, you know, so I was all loving that. But I just think that, you know, put content with, you know, the infrastructure. I think they're just in what they're doing on mobile. I have one of my other phones is AT&T. I'm watching it. The regulatory spot of that, I don't know. It's an awfully big deal. I think that would be the largest ever. type of acquisition of its kind.
So how much of that AT&T business is going to depend on them selling networking equipment and hardware and all that stuff into infrastructure? Because they do a lot of that too, right? Or are they not doing that? Do you know, Lauren?
I don't know. I mean, there's I didn't see anything, you know, specific to infrastructure and costs and whatnot or revenues or anything like that there. So
yeah, so I'm thinking, man, I think that we should do is just let them merge and fail. Right. I know we don't do that anymore. Like if we actually have a big merger go through and then they start failing, that we, you know, a bunch of people would say we have to bail them out because our lives depend on having this connectivity. But we should just let them do it and let them screw it all up.
Man, we're good at that.
I guess I'm still mad as hell today.
I was actually trying to put more
Cloudfinger coming my way.
Cloudfinger. I was trying to put this $85 billion into perspective. You know, it's actually not the biggest. Oh boy, Mark, I'm going to be singing that all night. It's not the biggest, you know, acquisition. It just to put it in deal term size, in 2004. This is Wikipedia's finest people. Did Comcast purchase Disney? Was that correct? That's what it says here in Wiki. But that was about the same amount of billions of dollars, you know, just put it in perspective here. But if anything, it's just, you know, the normal consolidation of such. But interesting.
Well, the end of this New York Times article says, the very end, it says, and in a Twitter post on Saturday, Steve Case, the former chief executive of AOL, responsible for the doomed merger with Time Warner, wrote of AT&T's move, hashtag deja vu.
Full circle.
I guess he's going straight to heaven with that one. Oh, boy.
Okay.
Have we trashed that one enough? Have we just, like, completely throttled that one? Yeah.
Speaking of trashed, there's definitely some sort of situation happening here with hyperconverged storage of sorts vendor Cohesity. COO Ricardo de Blasio cut loose by the board after an HR probe, quoting the Register here. Interesting there. Of course, with the title of HR being involved in probe, you want to get some details. Ooh, what happened, right? But no details other than he is no more. So I have a little bit of an opinion on this. I mean, I think there's a lot of competition in this space. I know they go up a lot with Rubrik in particular, but that's it's got to be interesting, right? I've seen a couple other people have left. I mean, I don't know exactly what happened with Nick, but we all know that Nick's no longer with Cohesity as well. But interesting, you know, a hungry startup losing leadership, something's no bueno.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. It's partly the growing pains of startup companies, right? So Cohesity came out with the idea of, this VMware integrated hardware machine, almost like a time machine for, you know, virtualized environments. And then Rubrik came along and kind of like took that idea and ran with it and got more money and came out faster. And so, you know, Cohesity has been trying to figure out its business. And in certain respects, I think you look at the investors around the two companies, it looked like Rubrik actually put together a better team management as well as investment in the whole thing. And that, you know, Cohesity was trying to respond. And so de Blasio came in as the, what was he, COO? That basically means the sales guy. And he's got to figure out how to make this company work and how to sell. And what happens, of course, when you bring in a new sales guy is the new sales guy basically runs roughshod over all the old sales guys and ends up replacing him because he wants his people in there. So de Blasio's got a network of people that he trusts and has worked with in the past. And I'm sure this is what happened, right? And he came in and there was all kinds of, people got let go. People got hired. They didn't work out. They got let go. It's a tough world. You know, it's a dog eat dog world and sales is like this. And it's not unusual, right? I think if you looked at this and said there's something wrong at Cohesity, you might say, well, they're probably not getting the sales numbers they wanted. But if it was really about, you know, fire too much turnover in the sales organization, nobody ever gets fired for that, really. They get fired for not producing. So if there's a if there's an underside to this, it's probably that Cohesity's numbers aren't what the board and what the founders and everybody else wanted it to be, or that comparing it to Rubrik, they feel like they're behind, losing too many deals to them, that kind of thing. Yeah, a lot of people got fired, but there you go.
Mark, that's right. It happens. It's tough business. It's, when those types of changes happen, friends, especially those who don't work or haven't worked in a vendor space. And then it's amplified as a small, hungry startup because there's no, deep pool of cash. There's no time and nothing but higher expectations. So it's rough, if you've ever been in those situations. And I've been lucky in my career, but I've seen those changes happen, and they are tough.
Yeah, I got fired after 6 weeks at Deterra, and my boss, Craig Nunes, he was there a little longer. He got fired after, 4 months or something right after I did. It's just like, yeah, the CEO there, Mark Fleischman, is just like, oh, I guess this is the wrong direction. We don't need to be doing this. We need to be saving our money right now. Goodbye, guys, right? Nobody fired Fleischman. And this is the way it is, right? That's when you go to work for a startup, it's like, yeah, sometimes you can get your livelihood taken away from you.
Do you think that it was the smart move? Let's say that you guys are right and that's the case and there weren't any other like underlying issues with the COO. Was it the right move to fire the COO, or does that generate negative publicity or even just a negative connotation around the name Cohesity? What do you guys think?
Well, you don't want to have somebody who's not in charge holding that role, because that's going to cause confusion for the people who are still there. So in those situations, you got to cut off the head and stick a new one on the mannequin and go with it, because there cannot be any confusion on who's in charge. And you're going to have social things happen where I'm going to align this way and align that way. These types of changes need to be hard and quick and final. And I think that you don't keep it around. You make a hard change.
Yeah, my guess is something really came to a head there, right? Something, because they didn't have a replacement. And according to the article, he was still listed on the company's, leadership page on their website. Shame on them, by the way. Really? You had something like this go on and you didn't take the guy off your webpage? Come on. Get it together, Cohesity. And so my guess is that there was a real hard parting of ways between de Blasio and the company. And, whether he quit in a huff or whether they just said, we can't take you anymore, it's over. There was nobody waiting in the wings there. That didn't happen. And now they've got to find that. And once something like that happens, it is actually harder to find someone and bring them in. And then you end up usually if you're trying to get somebody that's going to be really good, that has done this before, you end up giving away more of the company than you ever thought you would have to in order to bring them in. That's part of it also, right? So, it's just like, well, not everybody was happy. People got fired. It's like, no, it's actually, this goes to ownership percentages of the company. And it's a big deal. And it's not good.
Agreed. The confusion breaks Cohesity. Breaks the Cohesity.
Yeah, it's funny. It's ironic, right? The name Cohesity. It's like, whoops.
Yeah, I wish him well. Going through anything like that is tough.
I do too.
And I'm actually very much interested in that space, because it's like, this is a very interesting, they're charging into a new market, right?
And you compete with them on some level. I mean,
And we partner with them. It's real tacky,
oh,
right?
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it's coopetition at its finest sometimes, right?
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that this market is a big deal, and, got to see if it's going to work, right? And, there's one player. If there's room for two, then it's legit and all. Interesting. Last on our piece of news going into the fall and winter here is that Google's cloud platform gets a new cold storage service, which well-timed as we got a cold snap here. At an event in London today, or at the time of this post, Google announced some updates. It's called ColdLine, really cute name, for archive data and other stuff. I personally think this is a interesting deal, because it doesn't say it, but I think it's aimed to compete at Glacier. But I think that this cold cloud storage is kind of a thing. There's actually a market for it.
Yeah, I do too. People need a place to put something in cold storage. It's just that emergency location. If I need it again for a lawsuit, or I need it again, you know, to recover IP or something like that. But with the idea that you will never access it, right? It's there for a just in case. And it is available on a just in case basis, but don't ever plan to access it. It's perfect for that. And there's a lot of, times that that's what's needed. You know, it is that magic, USB stick. You know, it's just like, you know what? I just want to have this stuff here in case I ever freaking need it again. And I'll put it in my little home safe. And there it is. That's what it's for.
The street price of this new cold line storage will be 0.7 cents per gigabyte per month. Should you need it, it will be 5 cents per gigabyte to be retrieved. So that's interesting compared to the nearline, which is always online storage, at 1 cent per month. So the difference is 1 cent versus 0.7 cents. So a you know, roughly a third off the cost. It doesn't look like a lot, but if you're talking about big, big, big amounts of data that you're never in theory going to read unless you need to go deep to the archives, it apparently can add up. So interesting, and interesting also that they're doing a switch and save program, which offers enterprises that go into this 100 petabyte of free storage for a couple of months. That's a lot.
What? 100 petabytes?
It's for enterprises. I think that's got to be approved.
Whoa.
But that's a lot of free storage for a couple of months. It's in there.
Whoa.
In the TechCrunch article. Playing with, those are big boy storage numbers.
I mean, they have to be hoping that not that many people take them up on it, because that is huge.
That's mortifying amounts of storage.
Well, and to be fair, it says up to 100 petabytes.
Yeah, up to.
Thanks, okay, Lauren. I was having a heart attack until you just said
but
that.
But still. But that's like still a lot. Let's just divide that in half. I mean, my calculator doesn't even have that many zeros. I can't, how many hard drives would that be? Who knows? That's a lot.
At least two.
It's not a hard drive. It's goodness. Something else.
Wow. Apparently, also, it's available in geo-redundant services. This is on also some other things, by the way.
Actually, I said that, but it might be hard drives, right? It might be those helium-filled drives that have those ultra-low duty cycles.
We'll never know.
The helium hard drives are beautiful, by the way. I think it's just a great engineering thing.
Hey, we love the helium.
And they got a great a great little picture here on Coldline with their apparent – I guess it only has two nines, so it's 99% SLA, millisecond access with a consistent API. I definitely want a consistent API. And, you know, if you're going to use it less than once a year, that's where you want to do it. And then also it's targeted to archive. Kind of beautiful. They have this nice little storage class. Coldline kind of sits as a third offering. They chose green. In addition to multi-regional, which is blue, regional, which is red, nearline, which is orange, if they add one or two more, they're going to fill up all the colors of Google and I have to use another one. That'll be interesting. But anyways.
I want black storage.
Black storage.
I want black mirror storage.
Hey now, season two, now on. Or three.
Season three, yeah.
Anyways, I think
that's... Are you guys watching that, by the way? You guys watching
I'm done.
You already did. Already? Is it worth watching?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yes.
There were six episodes this season. Some of them were really good. There were a couple that I didn't need in my life.
So
but
for those listening, Black Mirror, a Netflix original series, it's a wonderful thing because every episode is completely self-contained. You're not missing any history by just jumping into what's new right now. So check it out. Good stuff.
Yeah, I want Black Mirror storage from Google.
Hey now. Well, cool.
Or do you?
Right, yeah, probably not.
Yeah, you won't be able to sleep.
I want my enemies to have it.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, at this point, I think it is time to move on to hot or not, should anybody object.
Do it.
I second.
2 out of 3. Sounds good to me.
Wait a minute, I think we had 3 out of 3 there, but...
Oh, I didn't hear it. Sorry. Sorry about that, Mark.
It's okay.
Hot or not. Selling back your personal or paid time off. a recent article that was shared by one of the executive members of the Insight in Tech We Trust board here highlighted the opportunity that if you had the option to trade in your vacation days for money, would you do it? Around the horn, actually, I've had that happen to me in the job place, wow. By the way.
You have?
Uh-huh. I have. And I chose to take the time off over the quality of life. Just give Rickatron a break. It was actually at my job like a number of years ago. And I chose the time off because I work plenty. And honestly, I'm good on the money side, you know, so I don't want for much. But so I think that's hot to have the choice. In that regard, the choice is what's more important. The fact that companies want you to work more, I don't care about that, or people want more money, that's kind of consequential. But the fact that people have a choice, I kind of like that. If people were required due to something being like the company being real busy to not be able to take it and have to take the money, that's not hot. But generally, the notion of a choice, I think it's hot.
Mark?
No, I don't want to go next. I want to go last on this one. Okay. Unless you really want me to go.
No. Okay. I'll go. That's fine. I actually had a debate with Justin Warren on Twitter because I posted this. And I think it's really hot. And like you said, Rick, the choice. Now, I don't want to be forced to give it up or anything like that. But I want to be able to sell back some of my PTO for money if it comes down to it. Now, Justin's point was that this feeds into this culture that we already have, that the workaholics move forward and that we shouldn't encourage, you know, some sort of work-life balance. And I say, you know, I don't think a week is going to make much difference in your... you know, it's great to give Rick a week off and all of that, but I don't think it's going to save your family or do much in the way of, you know, helping your spouse with the kids just for that week or something like that. I don't think it really matters. I think flexibility is more important when we're talking about that kind of thing. So I think it's absolutely hot. I would love the ability to sell back days or even weeks of my PTO. And a few guys even chimed in and said that it happens a lot already in Europe as well. So, I guess I'm encouraging that workaholic culture, but, you know, it's naive to think that that's going away. So totally, I'm all for it.
Totally not surprised that Justin piped up. You know, for the listeners, the three of us, if you can tell by the accents, we're from the U.S. So and if anybody's worked on a global team, you know the differences when it comes to the amount of holidays between the U.S. and other companies. And I work for an international company, and I have a generous amount, but it's still nothing like what some of the other groups get. But how about you, Mark? What do you think?
Well, I think that this is really ultimately hot if you live in France, right, where you have all the time off anyway. And then, you know, probably you could take the – and do you guys know how this is accounted for? Does it get paid out at the end of the year or something, right? It can't be done during the year because –
Yes,
because right
at the end of the year,
you could be, you know, you could get paid out for your PTO and then all of a sudden have a, you know, an emergency, you know, somebody dies, you know, a big illness or that sort of thing. Because wouldn't it be great, like, if you took your PTO and then it probably wouldn't be the same as healthcare leave. And then you found out that you had cancer and you need to go into chemotherapy and you couldn't go to work, but you can't do that because you already cashed out your PTO. I mean, so it has to be accounted for at the end of the year. I think it's really hot for people that know how to take vacation on the job, right? And so, you know, the idea is that you turn in your PTO, but you take the time off anyway. You just do it, right? This week I've got a doctor's appointment, or this week, Yadin, if you're listening, I've got a tooth problem, right?
Yeah, it comes out of that flexibility, right? Or, you know, people that work from home, I might work different hours than everyone else or whatever. But
no, I'm thinking pure scam here.
you just want to screw everyone.
I'm just thinking pure scam, and it's the only way it's hot, if you ask me.
Well, you
can't get a scam out of it. It's boring. It's not interesting. Okay, so you exchange some time for money. But if you exchange time for money and still take the time anyway, that's hot.
And when I had it, yeah, that is hot. When I had it, by the way, it was an end of the year thing, and it was basically the crux of, do you carry over vacation, which is a much more common practice, and then you had the option to pay it out. And actually, as I recall, now that I think about it, I never took it up, but this was, again, subjective to any group's implementation of it. I want to say it was paid at 75%. So that was a little lukewarm.
It's less hot.
Less hot. But, I mean,
if I'm running a company, I don't want this. I don't want this. I want, if you got time off, take a time off.
You got to treat your people right. And I think, you know, taking time off is important. But then you look at, you know, execs and stuff, and they don't do that. They don't take time off. And if they do take time off, they're still working. I do that, right? But it's real important.
You don't get compensated like execs do.
No, I don't. I definitely don't.
Hey, we don't know what Rick, gets.
No, trust me, I don't. In fact, we're actually down a car, so I'm actually paying my own Uber to and from the office these couple weeks. But and I'm always looking for X and avoiding surge, you know. But it's one of those things. I think that's an interesting choice, and you know, I think it's going to become more common in the workplace.
I would have thought you'd been riding your bike.
I've been too busy. The time, I don't have it. One thing I do like about Ubering to and from work is I'm actually doing a small-scale social experiment of what Uber's trying to say, if it replaces car ownership. It wants to compete with that. I found that going to Costco and Ubering home is not so bueno. But other than that, it's very convenient. But I'm done with UberX, though. I'm tired of stinky cars and people too lazy to drive down the driveway and that kind of stuff. Well, with that, we've got a hot or not. Everyone be wary of the cloud finger.